many times in life when we may look at the path we've chosen and wish to change course, we look for ways to transition from one path to another. Is today's guest talking to us about changing our path, staying put and managing the path we're on, or simply rethinking our perspective? Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer. Thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. I'm very pleased to introduce you to today's guest, Dr. Justin A. Frank. Dr. Frank practices and teaches psychoanalysis in Washington, D.C., where he is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the George Washington University Medical Center. He is also the co-director of the Metropolitan Center for Object Relations in New York City. Dr. Frank completed his psychiatric residency at Harvard Medical School and was chief resident at the Cambridge Hospital. Dr. Frank is well known to many as the author of Bush on the Couch, Obama on the Couch, and he's got something else in the works. Dr. Frank, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here again.
Well, let me ask you a question. Given that you have written books examining the behaviors of sitting presidents, none of whom you have met, I'm going to ask you to begin by explaining to the audience the Goldwater Rule and your sense of how, if at all, you, as a psychiatrist, are impacted upon by the Goldwater Rule.
Well, the Goldwater Rule was instituted in 1965 after the 1964 campaign of Goldwater against Johnson for president. In that campaign, there was an ad that the Johnson people put out about whether they trusted Goldwater with his finger on the red button, very similar to what's going on right now about Trump. And the ad was bolstered by the fact that there was a survey done of several thousand psychiatrists who were asked if they thought that Trump was Goldwater was stable enough to have that responsibility, and the decision was no. There were like over 1,000 or 1,500 signatures of psychiatrists that said no. Goldwater people sued the American Psychiatric Association, and they won a judgment, not a huge one, but maybe it was huge in those days, of $75,000, and the Goldwater Rule was instituted that it is unethical for any member of the psychiatric community to draw an opinion on some public figure that they have not seen or treated or without their consent. So that's the law, or the rule, rather. It's not a law. It's a rule from the APA. So people have not done that. My view about the whole thing is that it was not about ethics originally. It may have been a little bit originally about ethics, but it was certainly about protecting the APA from lawsuits in the future. And that's what it did. But my experience is that what I do is a psychoanalytic study that is in-depth. It's not answering a questionnaire. If somebody asked me suddenly off the top of my head about some public figure, I don't think I would say very much, if anything, because I'm not qualified to do that, except if I've observed a lot of things, I can say what I've observed. So actually what I do is what's called applied psychoanalysis, where I do everything except having the patient in my office. I read everything the person has written. I watch every TV thing they've ever done. I read things about them, their biographies, their history, and look for patterns of behavior very much the way I would do with an analytic patient.
Are you, in fact, in violation of the Goldwater Rule? You've written Obama on the couch. You've written Bush on the couch. A violation of the rule?
I think it's not, but then everybody is innocent in their own eyes. In my view, it's not a violation of the rule because I'm not shooting from the hip. I'm not just making an opinion and using my expertise to just say something quickly and briefly. I'm doing an in-depth analysis. In fact, I was interviewed 6 months ago and asked to make a diagnosis by actually a a writer from The New Yorker, and I said I wouldn't do it because I was in the middle of doing my research and I was not qualified to offer a diagnosis of Trump. Well, so I don't think I'm really in violation of it. But technically I am, and I actually called my the president of the APA before the Bush book came out, which was in 2004 it came out. I called him and spoke with him to warn him that the book was coming out, because I didn't want to cause a problem for my profession, which I feel very proud of, and that it's a very thoughtful general group of people. And he said that I was sort of on thin ice doing this, even though he understood it completely, and he would refer it to the APA, the Public Relations Department. So that's all that happened. It was fine.
There is, as you are working on the upcoming publication, Trump on the Couch, you've come to observe many of his comments, I don't know that he's written a whole lot. I mean, truly written it himself, but tell us what you've observed from your perspective as a clinical professional.
Wow, that's a tough one, because I've observed he is very much like a person who, depending on your perspective, it's the same person with a lot of different traits. So, for instance, if you look at him as a businessman and a real estate developer, what he says is about getting deals, pushing people around, being very New York-ish about, making the best deal and threatening and intimidating and verbally attacking people. All of those things he's always done. So in that sense, he's done those things. So the issue is about context, it seems to me. As president, that kind of behavior is really dangerous. And so I notice things that he says, whether it's mocking other people when he was running against them, that was in order to get elected. As somebody said, he brought a bazooka or a flamethrower to a stick fight when he was running for the Republican nomination. People did not know how to deal with him. So the things that he says are really reckless. He talks about the head of North Korea as Little Rocket Man. He belittles people. He makes fun of people. He talks about fire and fury. So he scares a lot of people because of his actual power, which is that nobody can stop him from pushing the button for a nuclear war.
Does he scare you?
He scares me.
Why?
Yes, he scares me. And he scares me because he's so unstable, and in terms of he'll say one thing one day and another thing another day. One of the things that's remarkable about him is that he's so in the moment that it's whatever he says at the time he says it is 100% right, and he stands by it. So he scares me because he's not introspective. He can't think. I mean, if you were having a conversation like this with him, I would think that he would not be able to be very introspective. And he's also not very knowledgeable, which is a bad combination of not being introspective and ignorant. He celebrates his ignorance. He's proud of it. He has confidence in his ignorance. And it's a real disturbing quality that he has. He has spent his whole life feeling powerful, acting like a bully, insisting on being a bully, insisting on having his way. And one of the things that happens with a person like that is they don't like to take in new information, because that implies they didn't know something. So it breaks their self-concept that they're the strongest, smartest, best person on earth. So what happens is that they end up not being able to read, not being willing to read, not wanting to think about new ideas, and they're easily influenced by easily accessible ideas. So, for instance, he'll watch Fox News, or he'll read Breitbart or he'll follow Sinclair News, and he'll believe what they say because their comments are simple, straightforward, and absolute. And he uses certainty as a defense against having to think. As long as I know it for sure, then it's a fact.
Whether or not I really know it for sure doesn't matter.
Whether or really not I know it, and whether it's something I look at or examine or think about. He would never ask the kind of questions you're asking. I mean, never. It would not occur to him.
Tell me about, there's an organization that is relatively new and is a duty to warn. And I understand just from my research that this is an organization that you have been involved with in some way. What is a duty to warn?
Well, duty to warn, there's two parts. There's a duty to warn, which is an organization that was started in Baltimore fairly recently by a guy named John Gardner, who's a psychotherapist and a professor, I think, at Johns Hopkins. And he felt that it is our duty as therapists, as psychologists, psychiatrists, psychoanalysts in the mental health field to warn people about Donald Trump, to warn the Congress, to warn people in authority about how dangerous and unfit he is and how unstable he is. And that duty is very powerful because it comes from one of the tenets of being a taking the oath of medical the medical profession, which is that we have a duty to warn. We have confidentiality, but we have a duty to warn society and others if a patient is harmful to others, in danger of causing other people harm, is a risk to society, is a potential child abuser or abuser. We have a duty to speak up. We can't just rely on confidentiality. And that's where the term comes from. It's from a law in California called the Tarasoff Law. So these people have gotten together, and they've gotten a huge number of psychotherapists and people from all over the mental health world to sign a statement supporting a duty to warn the members of government that Trump is unstable. Separately, but related to that, is there was a meeting at Yale in the Department of Psychiatry last spring in which a group of psychiatrists and psychoanalysts got together and decided that they were so concerned about Trump that they would each write the chapter of a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, and that's come out in last week or 2 weeks ago. And there's 27 different essays on all aspects of Trump, from the idea that he's a psychopath, from the idea that he is a malignant narcissist, from the idea that he has some kind of brain and mental dysfunction that would be similar to a form of early dementia, that he has a language processing difficulty, that he's impulsive, that he's unreliable, all of these different things. And there's a chapter on each kind of topic by a different therapist. And they're pretty interesting. And one of them is about the Goldwater Rule. Several of them are about the Goldwater Rule and justifying the fact that it's okay to comment when you have a duty to warn. So that book and then this group have sort of merged into one organization.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, you've said things... psychopath, malignant narcissist, perhaps dementia. We'll talk more about what these terms actually mean. But
yes,
for those listening who are struggling with, well, wait a minute, you're talking about a politician and you're saying all these things about a politician. Is this not a political vendetta against the president? What do you say to those folks?
Well, I would say that it's not a political vendetta, but it sounds like it. But that doesn't mean I don't have a political view, and I do. So I'm on the liberal side of the spectrum, but I don't think that people on either side of the spectrum would disagree with the fact of his behavior. I think the people who are Republicans or people who are not saying anything in public, according to Senator Corker and other people, are saying things in private that are not that different from what the duty to warn people have been saying in public.
So
and
what
that is that he's unstable, that he is thin-skinned. Anybody who will suddenly attack being spoofed by a TV show, by the Saturday Night Live, or will suddenly attack somebody with the Twitter behavior and flurry that he does, I can see doing that if you're sitting alone in your room, if you're just living through the computer, but basically that he's the president of the United States doing that. So I think that some of it has to do with appropriate behavior to one's position in life. It's one thing for a 5-year-old to say those things, and it's another thing for a 70-year-old president of the United States to say those things.
So I think what you're saying, and we will get into this more in a bit, but I think what you're saying is that the definition of a psychopath, a malignant narcissist, somebody who's dealing with dementia, all of these labels, if you will, are descriptors that you've identified and that others have identified, they would have the same definition regardless of someone's political affiliation.
They would have the same definition regardless of someone's political affiliation, absolutely. But what I'm also saying is that every child is a narcissist. They may not be malignant narcissists, but every child thinks the world is about them. That's a normal stage of development. It leads to self-confidence and that they really do think that because that's true. That to them, the world is about them. Their parents are there for them, everything, you know. They think conversations are about them. They hate having the door closed on them whenever it's closed. So children are very narcissistic. It's normal, but it's not normal when you're 70. There's a part of us that has that quality. All of us do. What makes it malignant and dangerous is that it's unopposed by normal, healthier development that can actually think about the insult, think about whether there's a reason even that somebody is concerned about him. He's unable to think about those things. So I think that's the reason that across the board people are concerned. I don't think it's a vendetta. I think we want to have a president who's able to think, and we don't. And that's really important. Thinking is dangerous because it attacks his need for certainty. It attacks his definition of reality. It attacks his what seems like an obsessional need to dismantle everything that Barack Obama did. And I have a feeling that there are serious racist undertones in that, if not overtones. So he's obsessed and unable to tolerate not getting his way, very much like a 5-year-old. So, except he's a giant person, you know, with a lot of power, and now the most powerful office in this country, hates not getting his way. So what he did recently about the Affordable Care Act, since the Congress never repealed it, Obama's act, he is going to do it unilaterally. That's because he's so angry that he didn't get his way. He has forgotten that he took an oath of office to uphold the duties of the president, which is to support and execute the laws that are in existence. The Affordable Care Act, for instance, is a law that's in existence. He is saying, I don't care if it's a law. I'm going to do what I want to do. That is dangerous. We've never had a president like that, ever.
Dr. Frank, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Stay where you are. Frank, isn't it reasonable to assume that someone who is the leader of what is arguably the most powerful country in the world, or at least sees itself as such, someone who thinks they can really lead that country, wouldn't they have to have a measure of narcissism?
Everybody who is president, has been president, has to have a measure of narcissism. I think there's been a real conflict in the even in the psychiatric community, where people see narcissism as pathological and abnormal. It's not abnormal. The fact that you want to have a radio show has something to do with narcissism, right? You like doing the show, and it makes you feel good and proud and all of those things, and that it's important. All of those are narcissistic things. The fact that I'm being interviewed by you and we're talking about it, that's about my narcissism. Everybody has it. And people who are ambitious for public office all have it, and they have a lot of it. People in the movies have it. Doctors have it for sure.
What's the problem with President Trump? You're saying that he's a narcissist. What's the problem?
I'm not saying it as much. That's not the issue. Is about his overall character. I'm not interested in making a diagnosis or giving a curse on him. I'm not interested in that. I don't go along with doing that. I'm much more interested in who he is, how he got to be the way he is, and how his very behavior and way of thinking affects his ability and capacity to lead the country, which I've never felt before. I've actually worked with other presidents and other leaders, and thinking about them has really been about who they are and not about whether they're competent. I've never thought about competence until this president. So that's one difference that's really huge. But narcissism alone does not make a person incompetent. What makes a person incompetent is the degree of narcissism that can be so powerful that they can never admit making a mistake. George Bush had some of that, George W. Bush, because at one point, remember, in a press conference, maybe in 2004 or 2003, somebody asked him if he ever felt it, what did he make a mistake at? He couldn't think of anything. Remember, he was paralyzed. He looked sort of at the camera, and he couldn't really think of any mistake he had made. I think he was paralyzed because he was flooded and confronted, but I don't think he was as quick as Trump, who would just say, no, I've never made a mistake. I don't make mistakes. That's a very dangerous person, because those are people who are not open to thinking, not open to learning, and that's where the narcissism is dangerous. The narcissism that's dangerous is that it leads, in some cases, to feeling omnipotent and all-powerful. And that's what makes narcissism dangerous. So it's not narcissism alone. It's the degree, and that people, can look in the mirror and see, think about how they look, or be annoyed at somebody who doesn't pay attention to them or doesn't think about their well-being, and they don't always have empathy for other people. Those are all part of being human. I would call them our inner Trump. We all have an inner Trump. This is different, and this is really a refusal to learn, a refusal to think, a refusal to ever feel that they've made a mistake. And it's this insistence, as he says, I have a great brain, I have the best brain, or I know more than the generals about ISIS. I know everything about healthcare. And then he was surprised when he said, you know, it's more complicated than I thought. He sort of, that was one of the few times he ever even acknowledged his grandiosity. I'm not sure where to go with this idea, because everybody has narcissism, but people are not, it's a real serious matter of degree of grandiosity. There are other people like this in the world. He's not the only person. Look at Harvey Weinstein. Look at people who are, take advantage of their position and don't really care about the people they're abusing or that they're taking advantage of. They don't have an ounce of concern. Those are people we see in all walks of society, but I don't want that person to be president. I've never had that feeling before.
On the other side of the behaviors that you are discussing that have been that are problematic for you, and I'm not saying you personally, although I understand that you have a personal view, but that are problematic for you, and quite frankly, the members of A Duty to Warn. On the other side of the behaviors that are discussed, is someone who what? Fill in the blanks. Is this somebody who's just all bad? Is this somebody who's all sad? Is this somebody who has had some challenges? I mean, we often talk about the impact of childhood experiences on the adult behavior stream, if you will. Talk to us of what you have been able to uncover about Trump as perhaps a little one.
Well, okay. First of all, I think that the question is a great one about whether something is all one thing or all something else. It is very easy to generalize when we start talking about this, especially at first, and I think that's important for listeners to think about. A freshman in medical school, especially when they take a pathology course, every freshman thinks they have every disease in the pathology book. They walk around and they're sure that they're about to lose an eye, or that they're going to develop some bone disease, or they've got this or that, because they're reading about things for the first time, and it's very disturbing to be exposed to things like this. The same is true for some of these psychological theories about narcissism and ideas about Trump. We all have issues to deal with. The thing about Trump and the thing about what you're talking about is that nobody is all one thing. So a person can be completely psychotic and out of touch with reality, and they still know how to tie their shoes, even wash, eat, do different things. People can do all kinds of things and still be mentally unfit for things. You wouldn't want to give all your money to Donald Trump and let him invest it, for instance, nor would you want to do that to a five-year-old. As his own childhood goes, his father was a very successful, hard-driving builder like himself, real estate man, who was, many people who knew him felt that he was ruthless. And at home, people who knew him, and there are books, articles about him and his childhood that Donald had, the father was like a tyrant at home. He insisted on certain rules. He was constantly criticizing his children. He was demanding that they behave in certain ways, and he made them very, very frightened. It was like living in a home where the father was not an alcoholic, but behaved like one, in that he was always short-tempered, very angry, couldn't stand anybody who would disagree with him. So Donald, who was the fourth or fifth children, five children, learned at a very early age to try to never let his father know that he was afraid of him and to go along with whatever his father said. So he did that as best he could, but the problem was, as a child, he was also very impulsive, and that he had an inborn aggressive quality that, for women know this more than men. Anybody who's had more than one pregnancy or several pregnancies will know that each baby kicks with a different amount of vigor and moves around differently, you know, that all babies are different, even from the same mother and father. Donald Trump was different from everybody in his family from the beginning. He was a very aggressive kid. He was restless. He couldn't sit still. So he required a lot of yelling at and required a lot of limits. So over time, he was an out-of-control, impulsive person that the father tried to manage the way you try to manage somebody who's really unruly. The father was busy working, but also he tried to manage him. And in fact, he became a member of the board of directors of Trump's grade school. hoping that he could have an influence on him in the school. But at the school, Trump was just almost uneducable because he was so anxious, so agitated. Today he'd probably be brought to a school psychologist, and he might have even been put on a drug like Ritalin or Adderall or something, because people would have thought that he had a learning ADHD quality to him. I have no idea about that, and certainly people didn't talk about that in those days. But whatever it was, he saw his older brother, he had two older sisters and an older brother and then a younger brother. His older brother was a nice, sweet, popular kid, but the father just was brutal to him. He wanted him to be a tough guy. He wanted him to be a businessman. He wanted him to be tough in high school, tough in college. And he wasn't like that. And he was really quite abused verbally. I don't know if there was a lot of hitting going on then. It wouldn't surprise me, but I don't know enough about that yet. But clearly, Donald Trump was a very abused, damaged person. So what you do when you are like have that happen is you develop secret ways of being. You develop a private self that feels safe, grandiose, all-powerful. You retreat into a world where you are God, or where you are safe, or where you can do anything. And so, like, you know, when I'm big, or I already feel big, I can beat any, you know, I can lick any man in the bar, or whatever it is, beat anybody in the house. I mean, that's how he was. And it's very compensatory for having been injured. But one of the things that I feel is important is that he also internalizes the injuring person. So even though he's been injured and he compensates by making himself powerful and feel grandiose and that he can do whatever he wants, there's another part of him that is an internal injurer in a way. I don't know how to use the right term, but he's internalized aspects of his cruel father. And so he has a streak of cruelty in himself that at one point can attack himself, but usually is directed outward. So instead of hurting himself in his mind, he is interested in being like his father. So there's the thing you talk about, people know about when the father hits the child, kicks the child, and the child kicks the dog. And like you, it's a natural thing of what's called identification with the aggressor, that people will become like the person they're afraid of.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, you're describing a childhood that in a lot of ways would be horrifying for anyone. I mean,
yes.
It's painful and judgmental, and it just didn't sound like he was having much of a good time at all. So from that perspective, when you think about this little one being, you know, trying to live and be safe in this environment, do you have compassion for the man
yes.
Donald Trump is today?
Yes, I do. I feel like I would rather have compassion. I would have more compassion if he were out of office, because it's too dangerous to feel too much compassion for him right now, because he's a dangerous person and he is not interested in learning about himself or in facing. I mean, who wants to? Nobody. Most people don't want to go over things that were horrible and painful in their childhood. I mean, you know, most of us, you know, it requires either that you're suffering a lot and you don't have a choice about it, but basically people don't want to go over those things. I do feel compassion for him. It's been very hard for me to do that because I've been scared of him and angry at him. But anybody who had that kind of a life, I feel compassion for. At the same time, he compensated it for it, for his feeling injured, by becoming a cruel person even in school, and by hitting people, by keeping to himself. He loved to intimidate other people. And so in that sense, I understand how he got to be that way. and understand that he's doing it to compensate for a lot of pain and hurt that he has to deny. But I don't feel... I feel that he's too dangerous to have the full level of compassion for him that I would like to be able to have if he were my patient. If he were my patient, he would be coming to see me voluntarily. He would want to work on something. He would be there. So I would have a very different experience of him than I do with him as a president. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does indeed. One of the things that, I mean, he said many things that are certainly of interest. And
yes.
One of the things that he said early on was that he didn't, he was a smart person and he didn't need an intelligence briefing every day.
Right.
Is there a measure of, is that about concrete thinking? Is that about... I can't handle the information. I don't want to take it in. I don't want to think. What's that about?
It's about this very similar thing. One of the things that people who develop a compensatory kind of grandiose sense of themselves, that they are all powerful, they hate reality, anything that would remind them that they don't know something. So instead of seeing the briefing as an opportunity to find out more information or to think or to learn, they see every briefing as a threat to their sense of themselves as being omnipotent and omniscient. So they have to push through that threat. They have to be willing to not know something and be willing to learn. Well, for most of his life, he was not willing to do those things and not able to, because after a while, you become unable to learn. So he doesn't want daily briefings for those that reason. But there's a second reason, which is that daily briefings originally were presented in written form, that he would review a briefing in writing and then discuss it with the briefers who would be giving him that material. He can't sit still long enough to read a briefing. He cannot do it. He's unable to sit, and he feels imprisoned every time he does a teleprompter show where he has to follow a script. And he can read enough to be able to do that as long as the language is simple. But he is not able to sit still and read a briefing because he's not able to take it in, like you were asking. He's also not able to transform it inside. I mean, he doesn't get to the point of having something inside that he can transform into a new thought because he's not able to take it in the first place. You have to be able to take something in order to think about it. So he gets briefed visually. They show pictures to him. They try to do it that way. But people know that a president needs to know things. They have a big responsibility.
Indeed. One of the things that you heard me say at the beginning of today's conversation was I posed the question as to whether or not you were talking to us today about changing our path, staying put on the path that we're on, staying or rethinking our perspectives, or what exactly is it that we can do if there's something that we want to do about the state of the office of the president today. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd really like to focus on what you think we can do, if we should do anything. We'll be right back. Thank you. Dr. Frank, sometimes when people are frightened, they will feel stuck, immobilized. And then there are other folks who, when they are frightened, will try to look at a way to change something, to begin to alleviate the fear. You've said that you are afraid based on the observable behaviors and language of our current president, Donald Trump. So if there are people who are feeling the same way you are, what is there to do? Is there anything to do?
Okay. First of all, the first thing to do is to recognize and to think about what it is that you're afraid of and try to identify it and not generalize. And different people have different fears. But once you have faced a fear that you have, then you can think of a course of action, because I do think that it's very important to be able to do things, especially if there's a president who you feel is unstable and is endangering our country. There have been town hall meetings, for instance, about health care that have been where people have been very outspoken. People talk about the ballot box. People talk about putting pressure on representatives. That's something one can do. One can talk to friends and neighbors wherever one goes about it. So what do you think about what Donald Trump did today? What do you think about this? I mean, constantly heightening other people's awareness. When people were afraid of the Vietnam War, people who opposed the war had what were called teach-ins. They would sit and people would explain and instruct, and that's what I think some of the people are trying to do in the duty to warn. So those are some of the things that one can do when one is afraid. One can share one's fear with other people. One can try to not be influenced by other people who deny something. I think the best way to cut through some of it, well, the cut through denial is a very important thing, but when you're asking about what happens when the denial isn't there anymore and we just are afraid and don't know what to do, I think putting pressure on Congress, and that can be done by letters. It's very hard living in Washington, D.C., because we don't even have a senator or a congressman who can really have any power. We have nobody to go to. It's so ironic that we're close to the seat of power. We're, you know, just down the road from the actual White House, and yet, and Congress, and we have no voice. It's really weird.
It's pretty extraordinary, yeah.
It's extraordinary, and it's really paradoxical. So to me, and there's also a matter of short-term and long-term. I mean, for me, long-term, working for D.C. statehood is a very important thing to deal with feeling impotent and powerless. We should be represented. But that's a separate thing. Right now, there's an emergency which people are feeling more and more because Trump tweets. Trump sets the agenda every day with his morning tweets. This is what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the NFL. We're going to talk about all these different things. He does it every day. So it's dangerous and it's frightening because there's a feeling of instability that's happening. So I think it's important for people who are afraid to get together with other people who might be afraid and try to think together and think about what they might be able to do. For instance, demonstrations are something. Educating other people is something. Going, if you're a church-going person, spending time in church and trying to talk to people in one's various church organizations about what's going on is important. It's important also when people who are afraid to be able to listen to other people who may not be as afraid or who may think that you're a nut. So there were lots of people who really love Trump. There really are. And they love what he's doing. They love the fact that he's going to break everything down, and they really like that. They like the fact that they're so angry and so resentful about what's happened with a country that's based, that's meritocracy and all these other things, that they really like the fact that he breaks things. So it's important to talk about these things. I don't know what else to say about it with the fear. I think that one of the things that I would want to do that's practical, if there's any way to restrict the president's direct sole power to wage a nuclear war, I think that if there's any way to establish some kind of intermediate, either the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State or a vice president or some other advisors, where there's people who he has to clear his decision with rather than just implement it. I would like those things built into our rules about how the presidency should be run.
It's not clear to me that even if there are rules, that he pays attention to them. So even if he were to issue an order, even if he were to propose a launch of nuclear weapons, what could happen to stop that if there were others who thought it should be stopped?
Oh, boy. That's the toughest question, because people have talked about tackling him and keeping him away from the button. I mean, it's been that concrete, that kind of physical, because you're right. I mean, I think that he doesn't listen to rules. He hates anything that's a regulation. He's fought against rules and regulations his whole life. He confuses compromise with defeat. He thinks that if you ever agree to something, you're being regulated by your agreement. And immediately, he parentifies everybody. And so he would parentify anybody who's setting rules and anybody who's making rules. So you're right. What could people do to stop him? I honestly don't know. It's what's the hardest part is the fantasy things, you know. There was a movie called The Dead Zone. I don't know if you ever saw it, but it was made in 1980-something. And it was about a guy who had an accident and he could predict the future. And one of the things that he could see was this guy who was running for president. This is in the 80s. Was a person who eventually, if he became president, would be very willing to start a nuclear war. So the question is, what do you do if you can see the future?
Sounds like we needed that guy around more recently.
Well, but then, you know, then you become a vigilante and you take the law into your own hands, and there's all other kinds of things. I mean, but so the question was posed in the movie, what if somebody actually could predict Hitler and knew Hitler in the 30s in Germany? Would they kill him?
It's a good question.
Yeah, it's a very good question. That's what the movie raises as a question. It's really an amazing movie to see, The Dead Zone, especially now. I highly recommend it. I don't honestly know what to do. What I would do is I would find people around who can yell and scream and surround him. You know, when you have an alcoholic, people do what's called an intervention. Interventions don't always work, but they work off more often than not, which is why they keep using them, which is that a whole group of people surrounds the alcoholic and says, no, 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 we are not going to let you ruin your life. We're not going to let you destroy your family. You have to get treatment. We are insisting, and if you don't agree with us, we're going to put you away in a hospital or in a place where you can get treatment. That's what has to be done with Trump. So I don't know how it would require an intervention then. If he's not going to listen to rules and not going to listen to these things that are put in place, and I agree with you, actually, the more when you raise this question, I suddenly realize, of course he's not going to listen to somebody who tells him he shouldn't do it. You're right. That's what a malignant narcissist is. They're not going to listen to anybody else. They know what's right. So even the idea of the 25th Amendment or having rules and having limits, when you have a person who is that impulsive and that unpredictable and unstable, and there's a combination of being unpredictable and unreliable, some people are unpredictable, but they're sort of predictably unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
And you can rely on them to have some modicum of judgment and ability to think, even if they are unpredictable. You know, like you never know that the guy, I can't believe the guy did that or he did this, but that, you know, there's something inside that's reliable. I don't think he's reliable. So that's when you have to have an intervention. The more we're talking about this, the first thing you learn as a psychiatrist, at least I learned, we start out working with the sickest patients. I'm not sure why that is, but we start out, all training is working with the most disturbed, most psychotic people in hospitals. The first year of residency is dealing with people who are hospitalized. The first thing you learn about people who are hospitalized is the importance of setting limits on their behavior. You cannot talk or think together if they are behaving in a way that precludes thought. Thought is trial action, according to Freud, and that's right. But when you're acting, you're not necessarily thinking, and you cannot talk and think with a person who's about to act. So setting limits is the most important thing. It's very clearly, most everybody knows this with an adolescent, setting limits, and it's very hard to do because adolescents may have the mind of a child but the body of an adult. The girls can go out and do all kinds of things and get pregnant and do things, and you can't control it. Boys can take the car or beat up a family member physically, even though they're maybe 15 or 16. I mean, it's that kind of thing, and Trump is the president. He's like that. And you really do need to have an intervention. I hadn't really thought about it quite as clearly as this interview is leading me to think, because I think it's too scary to think that that's what's required.
No, I was about to say, as you're talking about it, you're actually sounding more anxious as you are pondering this. Let me ask you this. You referenced something called the 25th Amendment. Can you say a bit about the 25th Amendment and its connection to adutytowarn.org?
Okay, adutytowarn.org. The 25th Amendment was put in place in 67, and the purpose of it was, so it's 50 years ago, the purpose of it was to deal with a president who was incompetent, who was suddenly had a stroke. How do you deal with lines of succession? How do you remove somebody from office if they can't function? It was really a result of the assassination of Kennedy, but what if he had lived through it and had brain damage? Then what would have people done? So there's several different parts of the 25th Amendment, but the part four is the one that duty to warn is about, which is, what do we do if there is an agreement that the president is compromised, even though he hasn't been shot and hasn't had a stroke? What do you do if the president is not competent to function? And how do you decide that? And that's what the last part of the 25th Amendment is about. And it has a whole set of making it very hard to get to that point, because it's very hard to kind of fetter or confront a president that way. So it's up to the vice president to see it, that it's dangerous, that the president is dangerous. It's up to then the vice president to convene the cabinet and then to decide to intervene. Or there needs to be, the other part of the 25th Amendment is, there needs to be a body of people who are selected by the vice president to evaluate the president's competence, like psychiatrists, like other politicians, like lawyers. I don't know who all they would be. And the duty to warn is about how to reinforce that aspect of the 25th Amendment, who is going to be able to compose a body to evaluate a president. As you said earlier, is this a vendetta, or do I have a point of view, and, you know, how are you going to be objective about this? Well, nobody could be totally objective, but the 25th Amendment is about getting a group of people who can get together and do something and say something about how to manage the president and who is an unmanageable person. And the duty to warn group is saying, this is an emergency. This is a person who really should be a patient, who is dangerous, and it's up to us to warn the people in power, the government, the president of the Senate, all the different people in Congress, that this man is a danger, is not able to use reason and think, and is impulsive, and is full of revenge fantasies, and wants to get back at anybody who slighted him or challenged him.
So, unethical not to warn.
It's unethical not to warn, I think. The Goldwater rule is actually an unethical rule here.
Dr. Frank, we could continue this conversation forever, and I am hoping that you will come back again. But for now, we're going to close out today's conversation. You have a blog, do you not? Is there a way that people can follow your work?
Yes. My blog, which I've been really negligent about writing lately because I'm so busy focused on Trump on the Couch, which is a manuscript that I'm working on. It's going to be due eventually, someday soon. But my blog would be justinafrank.com or maybe justinafrankmd.com, and it's easy to find with my name.
Sounds good.
And some people find it under obamaonthecouch.com. That's the second book. It goes to the same place. And
okay.
Then you can sign up. You can read it, but you can also sign up to get a regular blog delivered in your email.
Wonderful.
And I don't write more than once or twice a month these days, so I wish I was doing more. But
what you do is important.
Well, I hope so.
Dr. Frank, thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to interfere with any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to hear from you. Your comments about today's program or any program, send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's myndtalk.org. And don't forget, you can download the free Mind Talk app from iTunes or from Google Play. And a reminder, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.